Hello and welcome to episode 28 of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. In this episode, I'm in conversation with Roger Gare, University Secretary at the University of Leeds. Roger has enjoyed a long and distinguished higher education career, and unusually, all of it has been at the same university. After over four decades at Leeds, almost half of that time as University Secretary, Roger must be one of the longest serving administrative leaders in the UK, although no one has actually checked. Looking back over his career, he observes how the pace of work has undoubtedly picked up and working practices changed and moved from gifted amateurism to much greater professionalism. When Roger started out, he had to write out minutes longhand and fondly remembers the excitement of his first access to word processing facilities. We discussed the impact of the Thatcher cuts to higher education in 1981, just as Roger was beginning his career, and he recalls the dramatic impact of them on the university back then, including on the Vice-Chancellor, who was himself a former Conservative Education Minister. Whilst those cuts felt like a real attack on universities, the impact was not dissimilar to the COVID experience in terms of the scale and consequences. We explore the Leeds response to the pandemic and the wider higher education consequence, together with what Roger describes as the corrosive impact of the government narrative on the relationship between students and their universities. During all of this, Leeds has also welcomed a new Vice-Chancellor, and Roger outlines the difficulty of providing a proper induction for her under lockdown, and how well she's responded to the challenges of starting the role at the incredibly difficult time of remote working for many. Other aspects of COVID recovery are considered too, and Roger looks forward to the opportunities presented by his forthcoming retirement. Finally, Roger clears up some of the background to an architectural wonder at Leeds, the fact that it is home to one of the longest corridors in Europe, a notable construction that actually predates his arrival at the university. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my great privilege to be talking to Roger Gare, who is University Secretary at the University of Leeds. Good day, Roger. It's great to have you on.
Thank you, Paul. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So we'll talk a bit about matters pandemic in a moment, but it would be really interesting first off to hear about your career, because you've been at Leeds for a very, very long time. You're part of the furniture there. So how did you end up there? And well, how did you stay there? And, you know, what roles have you done?
I guess the answer is I stayed there by accident. I ended up coming to Leeds in 1980, would you believe?
My God.
When I was nearing the end of a three-year appointment as the first administrative officer of the Students' Union in York. So as that was coming to an end, I was looking around and there were a couple of jobs in Leeds and I thought, wait, don't have to move. I'll apply for one of those, and did. And since, so I started working for Leeds in the days when the late, great Edward Boyle was still Vice-Chancellor, and not just the name of the library, when we had barely 10,000 students. The place had pretty significant space on the campus, space that's now been largely filled by buildings. I've always had a foot in the secretariat, if you like. I started writing the minutes of Senate in April 1981, in the days when Edward Boyle used to put out a number of cigarettes in front of him at the beginning of the meeting, his prediction of how long the meeting was going to last. He was by then, I have to say, terminally and evidently painfully ill. So it was a bit of a poignant time, both for those in the room and for those who appreciated his contributions to the university. He died in September 1981, and was succeeded, as it were, by an acting vice chancellor who was in office for 2 years, which must be some kind of record.
Yeah.
And I cut my teeth writing State of the Nation type reviews for the acting vice chancellor. That was the thing that began to give a little bit of unintended impetus to my career, as it were. But I know it's a bit difficult to believe, but I was never particularly ambitious. I never set out to be a registrar or secretary. I can remember in the early 80s, I thought getting to be a senior assistant registrar or senior assistant secretary was about the pinnacle. And it was paid 3 times more than I was at the time, so it seemed like a reasonable aspiration. But being in the right place at the right time certainly helps. I did a bit of organisational development, was the first person to start dealing systematically with student complaints and things like that, but essentially became deputy secretary in 1998, if I remember rightly, and was appointed secretary in, with effect from February 2001. So I've done that job for just over 20 years.
20 years?
Yeah.
Blimey. And you must be in the sector, you must be the, you know, just about the longest serving secretary.
Probably. I mean, I've never systematically looked to check, but I am aware that faces have changed around me, so to speak. So one of the longer serving people.
So, I mean, you suggested Leeds, you know, was obviously an awful lot smaller and, you know, I guess greener back at the beginning of the 80s. But I mean, in terms of that kind of change over time, not just the kind of physical estate, but the organisational change. I mean, I haven't worked in higher education as long as you, but the thing that you notice is the pace. Cause certainly, you know, when I started working at the end of the 80s, there were, you know, it was quite common for more senior colleagues to nip off for a round of golf in the afternoon. And, you know, for some reason they were allowed to do that. And it did always seem not entirely fair that kind of thing happened. And also people used to go to the pub for hours on end at lunchtime, you know, which seems now to be most extraordinary. But were the working practices wholly, you know, Calvinist when you started out in Leeds, or were they a bit more relaxed?
They were more relaxed. I mean, I remember being taken out by a couple of colleagues for a pint, maybe even two, at lunchtime on my first day. And I generally didn't find that I was as effective in the afternoon, and didn't carry that on for very long, I have to say. But yeah, it was relaxed. But interestingly, and having moved from York, I was very struck by the way in which the there wasn't a lot of life in the evenings. York, I guess because it was collegiate in structure, people used to congregate in common rooms and for a drink at the end of the day. The first time I went into the senior common room in Leeds in the autumn of 1980, I was struck by how empty it was. The pace has certainly changed. The pace is we've become very much more professional. And you know, I started in the days when you could kindly or crudely describe the people who got on as gifted amateurs. And these days, of course, we have a very much more professional business-like approach to running what is a big organisation. Leeds has a population the size of a town like Mansfield, just to put it into some kind of context. And of course, digitisation has just accelerated things beyond belief.
Yeah, you were presumably writing all those Senate minutes by hand when you started.
And it was a red letter day, probably around about the late 80s, when I used to be able to get access occasionally to a word processor to do some editing.
Very different. So when you started out, of course, it was the heyday of that first really brutal round of Thatcher cuts to higher education in the middle of 1981. So Leeds, I don't think, was terribly badly affected, not compared with many other universities. But did it feel like it was really grim at the time? Can you recall?
I can, and it did. There was a real sense of shock within the academic community. There was a palpable sense of shock and depression, I think, on the part of the Vice Chancellor, who only 10 years beforehand, well, technically 11 years beforehand, had been a shadow cabinet minister in what was then the group that took over Edward Boyle stepped down from politics in 1970, and often it was often said that he would have been the Chancellor when Ian MacLeod died, had he stayed in politics. But I think he felt it to be a real body blow, he was an enlightened Tory and believed in the redemptive nature of higher education and the transformative nature of higher education. So yeah, it was a body blow. And yes, we weren't Aston or Salford, but nor were we York. We had cuts slightly higher than the average, as I remember, and long anguished meetings of a special group on economies, and then of the Senate and the Council. What it did do, I think, is introduce a sense of common purpose, which hasn't always been apparent since then. And I remember in particular the constructive dialogue between what we would these days, but didn't then, call the University Management and the AUT, Association of University Teachers, very constructive, collaborative, collegial discussion led to early retirement and voluntary severance schemes. And there was a sense of pulling in the same direction, which, having spent the morning looking at USS, I find conspicuous by its absence these days.
There are many changes. Of course, that period in the early 80s, I mean, you know, the recent experience under COVID feels to me like a bit of a parallel in that, you know, it's a real shock to the university system. That it feels like there is going to be an awful lot less money about to do the things that we were always hoping to do. And, you know, we've all lost income through commercial activities and catering and accommodation. And, you know, we're facing challenge in terms of research funding. I mean, in some ways, it feels like a really kind of similar kind of time to that period of the 81 cuts. Did it immediately take you back when it happened?
Honestly, no, it didn't. And I think for two reasons, Paul. I mean, one is that I think there are similarities, and we can come on to that, obviously. But one is that I think 1981 had a sense of there being an attack on the idea of universities or the traditional post-war conception of what universities were there for. It was a very distinct move away from Robbins, which had only been, 16, 17 years earlier. Whereas the pandemic is partly happenstance. I know Auger and what have you, and free speech, and you could start to drawing up a few dots over there. But it didn't occur to me at the time, because although the problems were probably as great in aggregate, it didn't feel to be so personal, if you know what I mean. And the other thing, of course, that has changed is that nowadays one's always conscious that we are competing with each other in a way that wasn't really the case in 1981. The sector was probably more homogenous than it is now, despite some disparities. But I think that was the other reason. But you're quite right. When you start to analyse it dispassionately, the scale of challenge is very reminiscent of what we faced in 1981.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's always difficult to, you know, such parallels aren't necessarily instructive, but it did occur to me that, you know, that was the last time that, and obviously it was before I was working at university, but that was the last time that there was something of this scale and magnitude that you felt, you know, really hit the sector and hit us hard. And you kind of got a sense of, we're going to have to live with this for some time. And we've already been living with it for 14, 15 months, and we can see it continuing in some form or other. So, you know, I do get the sense that, you know, the scale and the impact and the consequences of it are not dissimilar in that sense.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think one of the things that characterised 1981 and one of the things that characterises the present time is that there are quite profound changes with the ratchet in position, and we will not be going back to the way things were before.
I think that's absolutely right. And as before, I don't think any of us will be, you know, looking for help from government or expecting that you know, there is going to be a sudden turnaround, which is going to mean that all these problems and challenges and issues will disappear. There are far too many competing demands on limited resources. So no matter what government may say about it valuing higher education, I think it's clear that the financial challenge, if nothing else, and there is plenty of other stuff, is going to be with us for some time. Which means we've got to, you know, we, notwithstanding the competition thing, we've got to make our own way and our collective way through this. So, I mean, as you look back over the past kind of 14 months or so, I mean, what's your assessment of the Leeds response? I mean, you know, everyone I've spoken to in recent months has stressed how their community really came together and really did step up. I mean, is that your feeling at Leeds as well, of a kind of general sense of, hitherto unknown collegiality and support, mutual support?
In essence, yes. When one looks back on the last 14 months, one has to start by seeing the incredibly successful pivot to online education.
Yeah.
In a way, which isn't perfect, isn't the paradigm of online education, but nevertheless, I think delivered delivered something that was a worthwhile education for our students. And that was a collective effort, and it was the output of creative thinking, a great deal of student-focused diligence, and a lot of hard work. So I think there's a lot that Leeds, like most universities I know, can take a great deal of pride in. I think, on the other hand, I'm not speaking about Leeds specifically when I say this, I sort of pick it up from other institutions as well, but I think the business of being separated, working virtually most of the time, has led to some fissures in the in the body politic. Some staff want to come back to work and complaining that they haven't been able to hitherto. Others don't want to come back to work. So there are they're frightened to come back to work, should I say? I mean, because they've been subject to government propaganda for so long that the risk factor is difficult to move from the front of one's vision. And I really understand that. Indeed, I, to some extent, I'm not immune to it myself, despite now having had two jabs and what have you. So I think there are those kind of potentials for a little bit of centrifugal dynamic going on. But also, I think people have worked so hard for the last 14 or 15 months in what it's not literally a thankless environment, but has sometimes felt thankless. And because they've been working so hard, they're on their knees a little bit, and therefore tetchy. So I've never known a time when it's more difficult to get institutional communications absolutely nuanced in the right way without somebody reading unintended slights into it or unintended and unreal priorities. So I think there are some challenges that we built, not we Leeds, but we the sector have built up for the future, and I think particularly corrosive, just to be disputatious or for a moment, I think particularly corrosive has been the potential impact on relations between students and their universities. So I think the experience of COVID has certainly accelerated primacy of the consumer perspective on the educational experience, which I find very regrettable. And I think, again, is a change that it's difficult to see how one can reverse.
I think that's an excellent point, Roger. And the way in which essentially, you know, government has managed to point students back at their universities as well. You know, so if you've got a complaint about fees, then you should direct that at your university. Whereas, of course, it doesn't work like that. But yet they've been successful in directing it back. Accommodation, well, of course, we've been, you know, the most, I have to say, extraordinarily benign respondents to complaints about, you know, people having where it's our accommodation. But of course, we can do nothing about the, you know, the private accommodation that lots of our students are in, where they all have been paying for it, despite not being in it for ages. And then they are vilified often by, you know, by the press and also, you know, harangued by other people in the localities who blame them for spreading the virus as well, you know, particularly if they're international. You know, I think students have had, the most appalling time over the past 14 months. I really, really do feel for them. But you're right, it's put them in a difficult position with us, because whilst we're trying to be supportive, we're also having to say, you know, no sometimes. And that's really hard. And it's hard for them and it's hard for us.
You quote the question of fees, and you're quite right to do so. But it's in a smaller way, I think the government's attitude is best summed up by Michelle Donald in telling students that they should be expecting degree ceremonies this year. Yeah, absolutely crazy piece of hand washing worthy of Pontius Pilate. and completely at odds with other elements of government policy.
It showed a real lack of understanding of how, you know, universities operate, and the sheer practicalities of graduation, as well as the, you know, the, oh yes, I couldn't agree more. So it's been you know, tough for those students, and I do feel for them. But I think you're right. I mean, in terms of the way it has, you know, potentially impacts on future relationships between universities and their students, it does mean, you know, the likelihood of a, you know, some form of realignment there, which, you know, we'll have to manage. And you know, in addition to that staff new world that we'll have to cope with, which is about trying to accommodate those, you know, different anxieties and different preferences, whilst focusing on the importance of delivering on, you know, the university mission in terms of education, research, and the other aspects of his mission. You think, well, you know, we can't keep everyone happy, and yet there is an assumption that part of, you know, your role and mine is to somehow enable everyone to be happy all the time. Yes. And that self-evidently can't be what we do.
It's not something that we can succeed in.
Can I ask you, I mean, so one really interesting thing to me is that you, you know, you had a handover of vice chancellor during the last 14 months. So, you know, your previous vice chancellor, Anna Lang, is retiring, and then Simone coming in as vice chancellor during this time. I mean, that must have been really challenging for her and for you and the university, you know, that changeover in the middle of the pandemic. I mean, it must have been really tough.
I really feel for Simone, who moved to Leeds, more or less into isolation, and is having to get to know the place essentially through the screen on a laptop. We've done our best to create an effective induction regime, but I'm perhaps a bit old school, but I do find it very difficult to avoid the thought that you get to know a place by walking around the place, you get to know a place by talking to people that you bump into in car parks. Yeah. You get to know the place by you know, almost literally lifting stones, and hearing what students are saying to one another as you walk from one meeting to another. All of that has been denied Simone, and I think she's coped enormously well in the circumstances. But I have to say, it's not an enviable situation in which to come into a take over a new role like that.
Yeah, no, I think it must have been really, really, really tough. But I mean, we all want to get back in one form or another. And I suppose that thinking about the future then, I mean, do you think, you know, when we will ever see anything that was what it was like before, or will it be, you know, partial working for most people for a lot of the time? Or, you know, will we have, you know, an awful lot of our meetings and our activities will remain in the online world? What's your thinking about the future for, you know, for university management in particular?
There has been, of necessity, a little bit of a revolution in the way in which we use digital technology. And I think that is here to stay. I think it'll manifest itself increasingly in significantly more blended learning than was the case in the past. And I think the same is true of the way in which the governance and management of a university will be executed in future. So I'm hoping that we will be able to get the University Council together again in a room at some point, perhaps even before I retire. But I think many of the council's committees, you know, whether it's the Remuneration Committee, the Audit and Risk Committee, Health and Safety Committee, EDI Board, I can't see us going back to physical meetings in a hurry, not least because of the flexibility that provides. You know, yeah, once upon a time, it would have been almost discourteous to have brought members of council in for a half-hour meeting of the remuneration committee on a particular subject, for example. Now we just send out a Teams invitation and have a meeting 5 o'clock one evening the next week. It's so I think that we're, hybrid is an overused word, but I think that's the name of the future, Paul, don't you?
No, I do. I absolutely agree. And it's going to be, the challenge for me is finding the right accommodation and the right balance between those things. And it may be it's, you know, council versus committees. But the other thing is recognising there will be, you know, there will be times when you've got a mixed mode in operation. And that's really difficult sometimes when you've got a number of people on the screen and a number of people in the room. And, you know, the challenge of chairing that kind of thing. But, you know, it will happen. It happens, you know, in businesses up and down the land, you know, and has done for a long time. And it's just been accelerated by the pandemic. But it still feels new to us. But we'll get there. And it will ultimately make our lives easier and better, I think.
Yeah, and it enables us, for example, to attract people to serve on the council who don't find it particularly easy to get to Leeds. There are opportunities and advantages. Sorry, I didn't mean just to dwell on the council side of things, but it's a proxy for a more general point, I think.
So, Roger, you are retiring, as you just mentioned, after, you know, 40-odd years. Are you going to miss any of this?
I don't have the answer to that question yet, Paul, to be honest. I mean, I do now feel, I literally this week I qualify for my, what these days I think is a state pension rather than old age pension. So I've been thinking for a few years what would be the best time to retire. I'm now quite convinced that I'm ready so to do, not least because I have huge piles of books that I want to read before I run out of time. Go back to being a bit more of a student, if you like. Will I miss it? I'll miss the camaraderie. I'll obviously miss the intellectual challenge. But at the moment, I can't separate the life change from the COVID experience, if you see what I mean. And I haven't had more than, like many hundreds, thousands of people, I haven't had a holiday since September 2019. So I'm sort of looking forward to a break. And that sort of sense of relief is at the front of my mind at the moment. I think it's only later that I'll start to miss it.
And one final question, if I may, is that, I mean, one of the things Leeds is really famous for from before your time is the recording of the Who concert in the Students' Union, which is a lovely plaque and Who Live at Leeds and the rest of it. But the other thing it's always struck me as a bit odd that Leeds was famous for is the fact that Leeds is famous for having a very long corridor. What is the story with the corridor?
Well, look, I'm pleased to say the corridor predates even me. do you remember, Paul, I'm sure you do, that in the 80s, there was an advert for the Times which showed people building a bridge from side of the river, from both sides of the river simultaneously, and the two sides being on different levels. And underneath it, there was the strap line, "Don't you wish you were better informed?"
Yeah.
So we had this huge long corridor, which was part of the sort of 70s, well, 60s and 70s redevelopment plan, which would have knocked down everything that had gone before and replaced it by concrete and glass. The corridor in question was supposed to be the common level in on a campus on a hill, campus on the university that's built on a hill.
Yeah.
But it has this sort of egregious kink in the middle. And I was assured when I first joined that it was a case that they'd started from either end and hadn't managed to join it up properly. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it's one of the features of the university campus that I will think fondly of.
Great. Well, listen, thanks ever so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure, you know, we all wish you all the very best when you do retire. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks, Roger.
Pleasure talking to you, Paul. Thank you very much indeed.
That's all then from University Registrars Talking About Stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course. And if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.